Guten Abend from the FFC and the budget office, so that you can know who's around here. I'll start there. Honourable member, please start to introduce yourself here, and then you'll come all the way.
Yeah. My name is Ashwin Sarapan. I'm a member of the Community Foundation.
Good afternoon, Dan Joseph, member of the committee, DA.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rosina Omani from the AF.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm from the AF.
My name is Elizabeth Kukoki, who's from the NC, from the Northern
Pacific. Good afternoon, colleagues. My name is Polisinda Kaiso, from the African National Congress and the Whip of the Party.
Thank you, honorable members. Can I ask the colleagues to introduce themselves, starting right there?
Ah, hi. Zaid Lakhirin, I'm a member of Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
I'm Siloshni Gangan from Legal Services Parliament.
You didn't hear that?
Siloshni Gangan, Legal Services. Siloshni Gangan, Legal Services Parliament.
Afternoon, Chair and Honourable Members. This is Fatima Grant of the Parliamentary Legal Advisor.
Good afternoon to everybody. It's Melanie Gemma, also from Parliamentary Legal.
Good afternoon, Chair. I'm Lydia Orlandi from the Parliamentary Budget Office.
Good afternoon, Chair. I'm Nathan Collins. I'm Commissioner
and Chancellor
from Parliamentary Budget Office.
Good afternoon, I'm Sir Arthur Arnold, also from the Parliamentary Budget Office.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Daniel Parkins. I'm the Chairperson of the Finance and Fiscal Commission.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair and Members. I'm Chen Tsang, and I'm from the Social Commission Special.
Good afternoon, Chairperson. Members, I am Lee Nixon, Finance Fiscal Commission.
Good afternoon, members. I'm Lee Nixon, Finance Fiscal Commission.
Good afternoon, Darren Arons from the Social Commission.
Lastly, the Superintendent, the Chairperson of the Standing Committee on Administration. Welcome. I forgot to welcome the lawyers in the House, legal services. Yeah, welcome, colleagues. Thank you very much for joining us, Budget Office, FSC, honorable members, and allow FSC to shoot. The main thing, again, is we would also like to interact with you. So this time to make a presentation, but the biggest part is where we start engaging with you. So, Prof, can I allow you to look at 20 minutes, and we will then allow the budget office to come in, and then that's fine. Then we take it from there. Prof.
Thank you.
So the time is 22.
Okay, I'm a stopwatch.
Then go. Why the professor? think you are in it, that this document here, the Parliament Budget Analysis Manual, Mr. Jomo says this is available in soft copy. Says it's a good reference that you should look at. And then again, guidelines for standing committee on appropriation in the Democratic Parliament. Also, if you go to the website, you'll also find it. They sent all of us on me. Yeah. Good document, eh? This one is already in it. This one is already in it to all of us, right? And it contains some explanation for instance of some of the terminology that these guys are like to do, so that we familiarize ourselves with. And some important information. So again, because most of us as members of parliament who are migrant workers in Cape Town, so we do fly to where we come from parliament. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. The Members to say thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about the Financial and Fiscal Commission. I would like to say to you that part of the presentation is also to ensure that there's an adequate and proper understanding of who and what the Financial Fiscal Commission is. We've given you slides, and I'm not going to cover all the details in the slide. I'll deal with those points about what is critical and important for this committee to be aware of in its life cycle of 5 years going forward. My colleagues are from the Cape Town office, probably in Parliament office, the rest of our staff sits in the General Jams. But I think the first thing to say is that, and it's a mistake that also the executive is doing, we are not a Chapter 9 institution of the Constitution. We are a Chapter 13 institution. And in Chapter 13 of the Constitution, it sets out the whole financial, essentially sets the constitutional basis of financial law in South Africa, and put the FSC in that chapter. And that's the thing that needs to be good, it's seen quite differently, because we don't do the same work as the Human Rights Commission and the Public Protector and the other Public Service Commission and that. They do different work. Our work is about how do we advise and support public representatives like yourself to be able to adequately engage with financial matters. Whether it's going to do with the appropriations, whether it's going to do with the budget, whether it's going to do with the fiscal framework, whether it's going to do with loans and government guarantees, etc. The reason I'm saying that is the practice has shown over time in both finance, in all the finance committees, that there's a lack of understanding in all of the Finance and Fiscal Commission. There is no equivalence, let me be clear from the start, there's no equivalence to the Finance and Fiscal Commission. Not in Parliament, not outside of Parliament. This is the only structure that the Constitution is very clear of, that Parliament and the executive must consult, must consider the recommendations. Now the reason I'm saying that, the legacy reports over the years, including our submissions that we've made, the stuff that the FFC says disappears in the voluminous of other work that comes from either the budget parliamentary office, I mean, they're not long, but I'm making the point, budget cohesion, COSATU, submissions and other non-profit organization submissions. Where the missing point is that issue something that also the committee staff needs to look at on the object for you is that when we make submissions, you have to respond to those submissions as a committee on the appropriations, on the budget framework, and the range of matters. And in that you need to indicate whether you agree or disagree with that. and which one do you think is the one? It's not only about the, what it, what the national treasury involved or national government is saying. Because we're supposed to add public value and ensure the public interest for our parliamentarians to be able to know what we say. So the stuff that we bring to you are based on evidence, but it's evidence-based. Research, advice on fiscal and economic policies. We later in the slides I'll show you that interestingly we had a conversation last 2 years ago with Oliver to raise another VAT issue. But some time ago we already raised an issue around VAT and the importance of looking at the space around taxes and government. The VAT was one of those things we need to explore. So that's the thing that we're saying. So there's a hierarchy. There's a hierarchy in terms of the law. You can listen to everybody and find and use the advice that everybody gives you, but you have to respond to the recommendations that the Finance and Fiscal Commission is giving. And you also need to ensure that whoever tables documents with you, whether the Finance and Fiscal Commission's view needs to be heard on these matters. Because the Constitution is quite clear on it. And as I said to other members, I won't mention their names in previous, if you don't know this about Finance and Fiscal Commission's advice, then you say to the country you don't want the Finance and Fiscal Commission. But then you must also make sure that you then say to the majority party that you need to change the Constitution and close down the Finance and Fiscal Commission. And it's as serious as that. And it cuts across all the political parties because there's not taking into consideration the advice and the support of the community. The FFC is essentially then responsible and make recommendations that must be considered in terms of the equitable share and the locations of revenue. That's section 214 of the Constitution. Sorry, I was going to slightly on that. That is also about government guarantees. Now, I've been in the FFC as a part-time person since 2013, as a part-time commissioner. And then in 2017, I got appointed, July 2017, as the full-time chairperson of the FFC. We've never been approached, either by Parliament, who we report to, or by the executive on what should be our views in terms of advising Parliament before you make decisions on government guarantees. Now surely, that's a legislative requirement that needs to be looked at. And the same goes with, I mean, the issue around provincial taxes, that's not a DD because France has not actually moved in that direction. On municipal fiscal powers and functions, in terms of 2 to 9, in terms of provincial loans, and that's also the backbone because France has not pursued that line. But here's the thing which sometimes slips. When the province go into deficit on their P&G account, which is what we call the Postmaster General, Paymaster General account, if a province going into deficit, that actually tantamounts to a loan. It tantamounts to a loan in terms of the overhead expenditure. And that requires a view from the Finance and Fiscal Commission. The same goes with municipal loans. And how those loans and the guarantees get effected. So the Constitution is very clear in terms of must be consulted. It's not my powers. Then specifically on 214, the whole act speaks to the equitable share and the presence of revenue. And if needs be, since a person going forward, if there's a need to come and explain equitable share allocation, how it works at the provincial and national level, about our views are. Because we also have the view that equitable share needs to be thoroughly reviewed. Because there are arguments that equitable share is equitable at all. Whether equitable share takes into consideration the spatial areas like the cost of services in Northern Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, and in other parts of the Western Cape, outside obviously, if you go past the mountain, services are expensive. It's not the same price, so there's a need to look at that. And we'd like to talk to you about that, so really to start dealing with the division of revenue, the appropriation. It's so important that members of Parliament understand the internal benefits of that. On the government guarantees, which is section 218, it reconfirms that the national legislation and any recommendations of the Finance and Fiscal Commission have to be considered. So there are lots of constitutional responsibilities the Commission has, and we'll show you in later slides as to why we're sitting with some problems. Which is the problems that comes on for sometimes for years. On the provincial taxes, again, the constitution, everywhere that the FSC is written in, it actually means, it's meaning that the drafters of the constitution were wise to be able to determine that there must be a structure that advises parliaments. Which speaks to the allocation of provincial taxes. The same goes for municipal powers and fiscal powers and functions. Those are section 229, which speaks basically to what are the powers the municipality has. What is quite interesting is that we're starting to think about how do we deal with even municipalities starting to invent fines on individuals. And the question is that it's, we don't play in the political space, if you like. We provide the technical information and you yourselves as public representatives make so far from to make the public decisions. But we are also concerned that the poor, especially in the province of the Western Cape, how homeless people get taxed to fines. The fines are quite unexpected. So we see ourselves for the sixth parliament to start thinking about much more broadly about how do we make sure that we balance socio-economic imperatives with the constitutional requirements on matters. So 229 also then speaks to the it's not been that we're starting to pick up in the different provinces. There are some creeping stuff that's happening in the Western Cape where different type of municipalities introduce things which is quite onerous to the survival of individuals and households, in particular the poor. So section 229 then also says clearly that our FSC's recommendations must be considered. The loans matter I spoke to, and as I said, it's actually a big one. The constitution makes provision for it, but no provinces actually did that. Because obviously provinces don't have the necessary collateral to offset against a loan that they want to undertake. On the municipal loans, very clear that FFC under section 230 needs to be considered. Then more specifically, within the constitutional framework, there are also other constitutional laws, in particular the Government Fiscal Relations Act, the Municipal Fiscal Powers and Functions Act, Systems Act of Municipalities, your own bill, which is the money bills, amendment procedures and related matters act, which is giving you a specific authority as a parliament. That should be the Public Finance Management Act and the Provincial Finance Management Act and the Municipal Systems Act. And then there are obviously the others of provincial tax regulations, the fiscal framework and borrowing powers of government. Yeah. The bill of parliament, which gives quite wide powers to the committee and other committees, is clear that the Committee on Appropriation must consult the Finance and Fiscal Commission, especially when it concerns submissions to the Spanning and Select Committee on Finance and your fraternal committees in the NCOP. And you'll see that on the chairperson, the bill also provides a particular window period or time frame for 3 days. On the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, what we've managed to do is just to highlight the overall purpose of the body is all about, which is to promote cooperation between national provincials and local governments, and to be able to see then how the process describes the determination of equitable sharing and the location of revenue nationally. So the main role that we play in that one, and this is a submission that we annually do on the, in terms of the law, we need to do a submission on the 30th of May to Parliament, which is the annual submission on the Division of Revenue, we make specific proposals. We'll go through and then show to you later some of those proposals we've made. So essentially, the Commission must be consulted in terms of subsection 3, 40 days before the Division of Revenue Board is introduced by the Minister of Finance. So the Minister of Finance do give us the bill at least 2 weeks before the time, before he tables, because she tables the bill. Maybe never have the sheets of before you follow the honorable treaties. There's a lot of parliament then. So the bill gets grouped at in terms of section 214 and the different clauses of the constitution. And then we then explain to whether we agree or disagree with the division of it. But here's the important thing that doesn't, even if we disagree with the National Treasury, members of Parliament don't look at those disagreements. So the Treasury will, for instance, say H2E, which is one of those thick or door stoppers, which is called the budget review, where they will give a response to our recommendations. They'll say they agree, and here they don't disagree, and where they agree, there's no plan going forward. Right? And in the morass of all these things, our recommendations, our rebuttal phase recommendations, disappear in the system because everybody celebrates budget day. And we're all happy and we speak to them, but we don't look at the detail of sometimes some of the decisions we have had made a response to. And the national government responsible is an initiative. And it would be very wise if members of parliament ask the Treasury to come and explain the NSU. What is the NSU and why specifically with the Finance and Fiscal Commission's recommendations? It's critical because when the Treasury gives us the Division of Revenue to look at before members of Parliament sees it, before the rest of the country sees, we see the appropriation, we see, in fact we see the budget before many, then we'll say to them that you haven't responded to this, you haven't responded to that. But it stays there, and it should be taken further by members of Parliament if you agree on the collective to what you so our role there in terms of that is that we play a role in terms of the submission of the fiscal framework and revenue proposals on the division of revenue volume and appropriation law, the submission of the interim budget policy statement, and the submission of the adjusted division of revenue volume and adjusted appropriation. That's where we give our inputs. And the best thing that we could hear is whether members agree or disagree, why you disagree with this, and what you'd like us to look at. We don't get that. So what happens is that year after year, through a zigzag process, we table our submissions to Parliament, and out here, party representatives. So thank you, and we move on and go to that. Then, I think we can skip that, but here's the thing that we thought we needed to alert members of parliament, this committee, and it sits in slide 23, which is a classic example that we'd like to make. The recommendation that we've made. In 2001, we've recommended that we should have a costed norms approach. Now, a costed norms approach essentially speaks to the costing of functions, policies, legislation, and programs. So for instance, if a department is responsible for education provision, we need to know how much is going to cost of those services in the different provinces relative to the metro provinces, right? So a costed norms approach allows you for costing and pricing of policy and functions. For example, what is very clear is that services in education services in Gauteng is relatively cheaper than in the Western Cape metropole, relatively cheaper than education services in Northern Cape or in the Parliament. Because of the distance issues, because of the road infrastructure, because of the add-on cost that has been added to it. So as a result, you'll find a classic disjuncture between the policy requirements of the service and what the funding is actually saying. And then that is just at the end of this conversation in equitable share application. And whether equitable share is equitable share, and how do provinces respond to it. So it raises issues also about the urban bias. It raises issues about whether the delivery of drugs in a particular province, particular city or town or rural town, how all this stuff is costed and how that has put a burden on the financial fiscal position of provinces and the minister. So that was the one thing that we did. So every time when you speak to departments, they will say to you incessantly that our service is under cost, or we're going to go back to the president to ask for more money. We are underfunded. And all of them will be underfunded. But here's the question that I think we should always consider asking you. Underfunded against what? Have you costed for price the service? Have you costed for price the delivery of your service? That whole value chain of delivery of services from policy to implementation to monitoring, to the staffing questions, have you costed that? Because they will say to you that they are underfunded. What is also happening, which is a thing that we will say that we need to be on the watch out, because this is where many over years has broke, has actually transgressed or break the law. This is the Public Finance Management Act. Public Finance Management Act is very clear that any piece of legislation that gets introduced into Parliament has to be costed. So there has to be a costing plan, a costing and pricing of legislation, but with that, also the implementation plan. And whether it's going to be a phased implementation or a lock, stock and barrel wholesale implementation. And you get sometimes this stuff gets underfunded. So the costing and pricing is quite critical of policy and legislation. Linked to that, sorry, I didn't say on slide 23, linked to that is, we've also indicated that municipalities need to be paid to the very cost. There's also this element that we talk about, social backlog and infrastructure. So we've raised a number of concerns around that. So the issue around public level 3, the issue around our children getting hurt, the issue around educational sources all over there. We've raised these matters over and over and over again. So we've gone to the students from what the departments are saying. The same goes on the waste board. And the risk around that, the risk to the waste board is around the product. We've also raised issues on electricity distributor, the regional electricity distributor, electricity around that. Improvements in education, health outcomes, and housing has been an issue for years. And then there's the mental on the issue of the timelines of conditional grants, the determination of that. We think there's a process that this committee also needs to look at. That introduction of conditional grants sometimes just happen on top of the time of the budget. So you don't have the necessary infrastructure and other matters in place. So Chair, let me stop there for now. The main point that we're making then is the constitutional responsibility of the ABC relative to the work of Parliament. The second point that we're making is the idea that anything that is introduced to this committee or the other finance committee, in fact every single committee in Parliament that has cost and fiscal implications has to be consulted by whoever introduces it to the finance fiscal some of them come late in the line and they get angry with us and say, look, we're not going to support the introduction of this. And the last point is basically an idea that sometimes the recommendations get made, but there's no proper inflation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much, Doc. What we'll do, we'll go to the budget office because we want to take questions together. Right? So we'll take the cue from the first 20 minutes and who's the timekeeper then? Okay, please put that
I have my timer working.
We don't have to open.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for the opportunity to have the speech along.
Take your time so that you make sure that you give us the correct presentation.
As possible.
But I think what we thought, you know, we finalized the presentation this afternoon, what we thought would also be important is to just give the community the background in terms of how the value of the service and how it can come into the role of finance and so on. And I think we thought maybe the best time to start looking at international economy trajectory after 2008, which is where we saw a lot of growing expectations that government would deliver in all the social concerns that are faced by many societies around the world. It certainly let us put up, I mean, the poverty and inequality in particular South Africa has a lot of social issues. And obviously that led to growing expectations of how government deals with such matters or address those issues. And that has also put the role, or increased the role, expectations of the legislators in terms of holding government accountable in delivering some of these issues, and establishment of the Parliamentary Budget Office as a support structure within the legislation program is also proliferated beyond that, and so on. So there's a that big context to say, look, there's a need to establish an entity within the ratio of the legislation where it provides technical and analysis on what is needed by the legislation. To support the legislature's role in holding government accountable and budget measures. And we've seen quite a lot of them when we look at growth in parliamentary budget office. Different legislatures in the continent, post-2008, we've seen a lot of budget office established by different parliaments, both in the continent and elsewhere as well. And in 2016, we have realized we came together with some of the countries where we thought, as the legislature globally or in the continent are facing similar challenges, which also meet and establish a network where we can meet regularly, but to share ideas in terms of how we support our legislators in the continent, particularly as in realizing the 2063 goals that we set out then. And ever since then, we've seen quite more countries in the continent growing. I mean, more than parliaments in the continent that we are on, budget offices, and so on. And South African budget office was established in 2019, though the legislation was promulgated later, earlier in the year, which allows more time. It's 2013 years, sorry. No, the legislation was promulgated in 2009. And of course, the Act was in line with the Constitution, which said parliamentary rules that guide the legislation in dealing with the migrants. And parliamentary office was established partly to support or to help parliament implement the legislation. Coming back to international experience, there's a clearly common understanding what the body of the state among different countries and what some of the functions and what some of the dynamics and the issues that are faced by the budget offices. And clearly there's a common understanding that there's this entity which is independent or will provide independent analysis or advice to legislatures on fiscal issues or will support the fiscal side by the legislation there. And clearly this differs depending on the country that you're looking at, but it's not common understanding that you need to have that effective entity that can respond from the legislature's support in a very quicker way. And then we visual of primarily four kinds of budget office traditionally, which depending on the context of the country, four of those categories. The one that supports legislatures in providing alternative budget to that moved by the executive. Think about Congress traditional budget office, one of the bigger budget offices which at times provide alternatives to that government to them. And if you have the one that supports legislators in amending the budget or the money bills by the executive, and you have those that would say that stand, help parliament to understand the budget presented, and those that are still outside legislatures who are extension of the executive, but yet support legislation as well as the forces. And clearly there are some dynamics in looking at how these entities operate, and if that they are affected by various aspects, whether there's a legislation that the finance office should clear specific mandate by the budget office officials, whether it has reports directly to the committees or teams that are using different entities, authorities to work, and so on, you know. And on top of that, there are obviously human challenges that are faced by budget offices, which in a sense does affect how the office work, and those are some of the challenges that we go through. But I think the main issue is governance structure by the office have, and how does it relate with the parliament and other stakeholders, and what budget does the entity have budget and function and so on, the structure of the office. Coming back to how the office was established, there was clearly a very detailed process where there was various consultations in various sectors, various stakeholders, and so whether should South Africa have a budget office, should South African Parliament has a budget office, and clearly from different sectors there was agreement to look. South African legislatures we did have a budget office which is more supportive at the with wide support to legislatures in fiscal issues as it was raised to the management and the country. Of course there are also benchmarking approaches in how other countries are doing and how the structure of the South African should be, and as a result of the budget bill that we are started with South African political established as a juristic person within the entity, which is led by the director and the accounting officer who comes to the parliament, which means the instrument will be accounting to the parliament on its functions and its mandate and in how it uses public finance itself. And further developed as a part of the governance structure an advisory board which obviously which the director will consult when there are issues related to operation of the office, which the board comprises of two house chairs, two house chairs and four committee chairs, including standing and operation chairs, who form part of the advisory panel, advisory board there. And also that as to his mandate, vice office of the senior chancellor, you know, to fulfill his mandate as the KDWF. And also decide that public budget office should have the clear way able to obtain information for its analysis as in case they should be so from state office. So that's quite clearly indicated in the legislation. There are clear specific core functions as detailed in the act. I think what it implements is that the first through around the function of the office was largely to say what are the specific things that the office could do as part of the voting legislation, which includes research on budget and fiscal regulatory matters, which will help Parliament in implementing the act itself. So there are so many specific things that I won't go into detail, but there are clearly specific mandates set out in the act what should the office do as part of support to the Parliament. In particular, the four committees which indicate finance and approaches from the both houses, which we provide support by connect research and provide analysis when they need advice. Very small office, the establishment of a 13 team, a director, the two of us here, and of course other six specialists. And I think in total, it's quite as huge experience, you know, of experience, years of experience in consolidation, even if you consider all the starting back in the office. More than 6 years, quite a lot of experience, which we do have as a team to provide that support. We don't have a director of both kinds of things. As I said, the main committee that the Act indicate that people should advise or support in the budget process is those four committees, finance and appropriations for both houses. So what's been happening over the years, we
voice or a request or every budget on every single time to sit down and provide analysis to come and present to the committee. These are the issues that we think the committee should consider, or the committee should send us a request. We have an issue particular program is looking to ask kind of so those problems. But of course, the Act makes provisions that we could also support our community environment subject to ambulance capacity there. As a result of realizing that Parliament has 490 members with 160 committees, it was quite difficult to work with the Member Solution Committee to establish sort of a workflow process where we say if we're going to do work to Parliament as part of support to legislature, the request for work should come through the committee. If a member or committee has a particular issue, he wants people to look it on their behalf, they send a request to the chairperson, the chairperson send a request to the CEO, and the response also through that process in a sense. But of course, even during the process, we do engage with individual members, you know, the specific issues, clarity, and so on. So we have that workflow process in place. Some of the outputs of what both standard outputs that we produce for Parliament, for communities, but you know, your, what I call regular outputs is your pre-budget analysis and pre-MTBS analysis. Before the budget is presented, the pre-analysis of Parliament will brief the committees on what are some of the key issues that are important to consider and so on, what the status of public finance before the budget is presented. And in subsequently, what the budget is presented will provide the committee to such analysis the kind of key issues that need to take into account where the one where they present the sphere. But also happens during the adjustment process, as we will be doing next week, giving an input on the appropriation part of our support to the committee. Quarterly, we produce economic brief, which provides Parliament with the status, committee data, so some of the key issues in the economy that we should take into account. Also, briefs will provide status quo of political situation at the national and the provincial level. Also, have been doing a lot of work behind around national development plan. There's a lot of discussion today, Chair and members, about how does the budget link to the targets and MPPs. We've done a lot of work around that where we apply to finance. These are some of the issues on national budget, on national development plan, and how has the alignment and outcome has been aligned to the target percent. Also look at focus, auditing government focus on revenue and highlight on the issues. And also research. I mean, members would say, look at this research for us and come and advise us on the issues we need to consider. So this is roughly some of the work that we've done. Specifically to the thing we've done, our corporation, we have done some work over the years which were, you know, directly requested from the appropriations committee, looked at SOE's financial situation, particularly looked at ESCOM. I think in 2014-15, there was requested a special appropriation, or special appropriations, and the appropriations committee requested us to provide analysis on the ESCOM finance situation. Also, as part of the expert generation, we looked at various costs in terms of what other measures which in the country, comparing the package of nuclear, coal-related and other form of energy circulation. We also looked at the free higher education, where obviously a lot of defense of the students asking Parliament to, you know, provide free education, also provide analysis on that at a later stage. And one of the things that we had talked about this morning was around the appropriation scheme. Past 2 years there has been concern from focusing committee where the committee has recommended, or the discussion committee, whether should there be a proposed amendment. So, you know, it's quite interesting, yesterday I had a lot of discussion from members saying why do you take money from there to put there, and so on. There has been a lot of discussion around that, and we provided input as well to Parliament. We can share some of these work later that we have already given out to the committee. We've not only done analysis, we've also engaged with the stakeholders in the space. As I said earlier, this is a very international is a recognized sector where other countries engage with other countries of similar types and share ideas that we still have part of our core functions in our community. The network that we've established will meet the African budget offices and members also involved and engaged on this issue. We also invite other budget offices of interest and we'll kind of guide and guys from UK and other non-African countries that also be part of our engagement. We also engage a lot with FSC, many government agencies do engage with them regularly. And also the multilateral level, we have such engagements on a regular basis and shaping ideas on understanding some of the issues that affect fiscal and also domestic issues. I'm going to bother with the slide. I think that as you, I think one of the researcher colleagues has presented it. But now I think this one just to provide, share with what we also think at some of the specific money bills that appropriations committee ought to provide or approve or adopt, maybe by government decision. Even in terms of that, in terms of the act that we support you on before you approve all the bills. We've given time, that's how long it takes for you to put those. But I think the purpose of this slide really changed. But just the slide that, as there's been discussion yesterday, that the money bills act, the act that provides rules for parliament to approve budget and related instruments, does give provisions to parliament to have a meaningful engagement, to say, look, if you do want to have more time to deal with matters with a clear objective, you can have that meaningful engagement by extending time and so on. But also, it does provide Parliament with power to actually amend these money bills. If you feel like, I know the big issue is about Plaza and Sandra. If you feel that you don't want that money to go to Sandra, wants to go elsewhere, the money bill allows that allow Parliament to actually engage in that regard. But of course, there's a requirement for what needs to be taken into account in this regard. Chair, in conclusion, what I'm saying is that TPO is establishing land with intentional experiences. And of course, in South African establishment at TPO, there was a lot of context in terms of how well South African context. In our work, also taking into account South African context. And this establishment is just testing and accountable to Parliament and provide objectives, advice, and political issues for committees, and we don't recommend. I think one of the points I had, that we don't give recommendations to committees, we provide all these analysis, and empower members with that information, they make decisions in terms of whether to approve or not to approve, they have that information. I think that's a very, one of, in the level of interpretation of the Act, which is one of the differences with how we differ with FSC, Professor Fax was criticizing they gave recommendations. We don't give recommendations in the Parliament of Fax often. Establishing terms of the Act, which is quite clear what needs to be done, what needs to do, and processes and so on, and the mandate clearly as outlined in the Act. And we've got both regular output that we provide to committees, and we've got also the research where you can identify an issue. The issue of infrastructure. TPO will look at infrastructure for us for whatever the case might be. We do that. And of course, as I mentioned, due to limited capacity, we have a workflow process which just structure our work through the committee as opposed to individual members of parliament. And of course, we have prioritized the budget and we don't intend budget policy statements always. So if we have in February, we can only focus on those. And October, we can focus on those. Any ad hoc research request will always put it back to this focus on the budget and MGK. Thanks so much, Chair.
Thank you so much for the presentation. Thanks, Prof. Honorable members, you know how we do it. Let's see. Ready to decide, okay. We'll start with honorable teachers. and let's limit ourselves to two questions and see how far we go. And again, let's be crisp, precise, and to the point. Thank you. If we have got more time, again, we'll come back and take the second bite. So you ask your questions in terms of importance and preference of, from your side. Hello, Peter.
Thank you very much, Shepperton, and once more thank you to the Prof and the delegation as well as the budget office team for the two presentations. Thank you very much for helping us to be able to continue carrying out our mandate. There's just one. I'm happy, Prof, you made quite a number of examples that has got relevant to where I come from in terms of the cost of service delivery in relation to the size of the Northern Cape and challenges faced by the rural communities in Mpopo, Eastern Cape, as well as KZN. My question, Shepherd, and like you said, we must limit ourselves to two questions, is on that slide, I don't see this, 16. There is the issue related to the municipal fiscal powers and functions, where the Prof made reference to municipalities imposing heavy earning surcharges. My question is, what is the role of the FFC in ensuring that municipalities cannot impose the heavy surcharges that make it impossible for the community or the citizens to can afford services? For example, the issue of electricity. We know the two-pill policies that are very important. We speak about one, which is the Integrated National Electrification Program, but also the three basic electricity. But you find that even people who have registered for indigent at times don't have access to electricity. That has a bearing in the quality of service, in the social impact related to health and other sectors, as well as the performance of learners in school because they are unable. You would know that in the Western Cape we've got big challenges of houses burning down, especially in the winter seasons, primarily because people now start stealing electricity. So I think it is important that one... But also, how does the FFC curb municipalities from seeing the electricity revenue as the one source of revenue that, I don't know if that's the right word, that they do as they wish with that. There's a finance word for it, I don't know what it is. But they actually regard it as that revenue that they can just do as they wish, and there's no conditions attached to it. The other one, Shepherd, is related to conditional grants. It's on a slide. Yeah, you're not you. I don't know now. But it's recommendations. You speak about conditional grants, but National introduces a conditional grant at times. And then, as the service runs, they take a decision to phase out the conditional grants. And then say provinces or whatever entity or must absorb the cost. Is that not having a bearing on the wage drift? And how can the FFC be able to intervene in that particular space? Jefferson, I will not come back, but I'm just going to add this one. If the FFC mandated or able to determine which sphere of government is better placed to render a particular service, like especially in the area of concurrent services, functions, I mean.
Thank you very much, Jefferson. Some of the poor, the good, that we should very clear. I was struggling as to whether but allow me to say thank you very much, Professor, for the presentation and our people from the Parliamentary Budget Office. Allow me to say if this issue of the municipality when it comes to paying of levies and taxes for our people is not going to be taken care of, people in the urban areas really are in trouble. You go to the rural area where I come from, you will never ever see people sleeping under the bridges with their new blankets or whatever. You will never see them. Because the traditional leaders, they are really trying their level best in order to make sure that no one sells the ground where maybe his own house has been built. But then now you come to the rural area, the urban area, especially in the streets of Cape Town. And that you just notice that these people are really blue blankets and mattress, nice one, under the bridge, something from here. So maybe if this can then be taken into consideration, I believe it will end up assisting our people. Thank you. I wanted to make an addition on what you said. My number two question on the actually, they did ask a question. This one was just an addition. So my number one question. I have a serious question and actually frustrating that on your slide number 8 or page 8 on organizational character, how can really Parliament be so stingy in not filling up the direct convention? I mean, people out there, we have even in our focus staff, you might find that we have people who qualify for this position. But because the position is not being advertised, they are struggling there in that office. And I don't understand how the office, this big office, is just running without the aid. Even when you go along the streets of Cape Town, even a blind person with this disability or a disability, having a walking stick, and the robots are sitting there. There's something that is directing them. I'm sure you will respond that this has been advertised and tomorrow it will be filled. Thank you very much.
That was my last
question. Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start with the answer. Don't forget to remind them.
In terms of considering the numbers gained,
because, for instance, in the Cape you have checked, even also in the Cape and then say, we have a situation there where still you have people who are in this 25-year period of our democracy. Okay? We still have labor rights in the province of the land. Where Umunabantu, who literally moved from Cape and moved from Eastern Cape to either Western Cape or, like, you know, Gauteng. And when census comes in, such people would be in those white areas. Hence, even the number check of the rural provinces would now be labeled as, you know, dropped or very, you know, a low. While the actual inhabitants are literally out there for jobs. The second one would be to Kibio. In the light of the fact that you're saying you are more athletic, unlike in terms of the competition. But now, check. Here is the scenario where the athlete of PBO is what meet the concrete. And we as a committee, we have to use it when you are engaging the department and anyway. Now, my question would be, can we quote because we have to have the source check. And that's why I need to have the honor.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. President. My name once again is Oscar Makapa from Kaltin. I'm with the African National Congress. Chair, both my two submissions will be directed to the FSP. The first one is on the lamentation of lack of movement by government as far as the FSP's recommendations are concerned. I would want to argue that it's common knowledge, or it has been said many a times, that the Republic of South Africa and the governing party, or let's say government, has good policies. The problem is in the implementation. So the direct question would be, how would the FSP advise this committee, whilst we do our oversight, to ensure that these good policies are being implemented? But I also have a different view, Chair, with slide 23 from the FSP, on the recommendations for the acceleration of accreditation of municipalities. You just clarify or alert me if I'm on the wrong issue on the issue of human settlement provision. Because from the city that I'm from, the city of Swan, there is movement. We are at the stage where we have been approved to formalize, and then we are on the stage now of applying for the first stage of construction. So there are movement in this regard. So I disagree that there is no movement from the part of government. And I wonder in many instances where the prof has said that there is no movement, is it really accurate? Because I think that somewhere information is not flowing back to the discussion that led to the recommendations being made by the FSP. The last one, Chair, is based on the interpretation of what the Constitution prescribes to government as far as the role of the FSP is concerned. In Prof's opening remarks, he alluded to the fact that government has not approached the FSP when it speaks to issues of loans and guarantees. I just want to understand, because if you read the Constitution, I'll speak on 238 on municipal loans, sub 2, it speaks of the national legislation that cannot be enacted unless recommendations have been received from the FSC. Now, I'm looking at a special appropriation for the FAA of last year for 5 billion. It cites the Money Bills Act and the PFMA. So meaning that the national legislation that requires in acting after recommendations has been complied with. So it's Prof saying every time a special appropriation or a loan is sought by an organ of state, recommendations are still required. And then you correct me, there are lawyers here who are here. Because my interpretation is that it's only at the stage of legislating an enabler for these loans and guarantees to be provided, where such recommendations will then be sought from the FSB. The next might be, I think you corrected, I just need clarity there. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Rosina Komana, Bank of Democrats, representing the EFF. I would like to ask the discussion today that in the presentation, they state that they are the recommendations. And my question is, are they also upon making recommendations, particularly to municipalities? Because we find that there are municipalities, particularly in the ESCOM issue, where you find that the poor people's tests are going deeper. The municipalities will be going deeper into the poor people's tests. To say, you find that when then poor people are buying electricity from the municipality, so this percentage should be taken. Let me say that the person will be buying 100 electricity. So the person will only get 50 electricity. The other 50 would still have to be in the municipality. So my question there would then be, is there a recommendation? Or if there was a recommendation, then what is the aftercare thereof? And the second question, Chairperson, so you give since where I am in the government, that we say we want to enhance unemployment and capital. I find it very, very disappointing to have the Parliament Budget Office, which is supposed to advise the Parliament, but it's a chair with a vacant post. I think I agree the same sentiment to say we need to maybe to be informed of how long has this post been vacant, why is it has been taken, and how far is the process, if there is one. So that we maybe speak to the guy with a particular information. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity, and thank you for the presentation. I just would like to know from the professor, I don't have my constitution with me, Chapter 13, which deals with the establishment of that. I just want to ask a straightforward question. Who do you actually report to, besides sharing information and making presentations to so many institutions, who do you report to? In other words, who's the last one that should look at that recommendation that has been made? I think you asked both the FFC and the budget office. That's the one thing. And then I would like to know if the Provincial can tell us of all the recommendations that in your view being ignored, which one in terms of our current situation for well, the crisis of the country in, whether it's at Parliament itself, not in this committee or committee, or is it at the President's office? You know, how far does these reports go? Who comes look at it now besides us? If we forced to hear, where else should it be picked up? And then just the process itself of the FHC. Because I know it already started in August. I think I'm correct, and we work our way through to the next budget, the next year in February. So where is the time frame of the recommendations that comes here to this committee? Is that not a problem there? That we should be on your research and your recommendation come to this committee much earlier. Because I think we are in a pressure in terms of time, dealing with other time constraints with the way the Constitution is written or financial act is written. So I think that is the question. And then the budget oversight, I would also like to know, you know, if there's a way that you can resolve as soon as possible, if you can have the proper leadership in terms of the organogram that is fully complied with, that we can have the full capacity there in that office. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. My name is Ashwell Serapin, I'm also from the Democratic Alliance, and I am from Gauteng. My question then this to both the Parliament Budget Office and the MFC is, do you make your past reports available and your past recommendations, and if so, from where can I get them from? And then to the FSC, do you give different recommendations to this committee as a national committee than you do the finance for this? I mean, you say you produce reports to both. I'd like to know where things diverge. I mean, what do you say to the finance minister that is sitting here so much more time compared to us? And also the FSC, do you make yourself accessible to MPs? The Parliamentary Budget Office obviously sits in Parliament, so they can go upstairs. But you guys are better litigants. If I needed to make an appointment and come and actually see how you work and what's going on, and would, do you actually make yourself accessible at that level? And then to both. Does the enabling legislation in the case of the Parliamentary Budget Office, the Money Amendments Procedures Bill, and the FSC Act, FSC, hinder your performance and your ability to fulfill your role as an officer? And if so, should we be pursuing amendments to those respective bills to make your, give your respective officers more teeth in terms of maybe accessing information from Treasury, or I don't know, obviously I'm not at a work in your offices, or you can need to tell us how your enabling legislation helps.
Yeah, my name is Kondisile Kaiso from Brisbane. I just want to make there's an interesting issue here on the RED from the Parliamentary Budget Office. It seems as if there was something that you submitted which could not be considered. But I just want to go back on this. I'm trying to locate that, but it's one of the previous work that we did, which could not be considered. It emanates from the issue of electricity, originally the RED. Yeah, electricity redistribution. The red. So I just wanted to batch a little bit. Why did you bring it? So that one can comprehend the context so that we can see how, what sort of intervention that one comes into. Because now, you know, in the light of mere science and this and that, perhaps we just want to draw some information that would help us to, you know, to see what sort of intervention we should come into the context.
Thank you, Honourable Members. I will come with my question or questions during the second round, but since there are many energy questions you should ask, Prof, you have been very vocal about ESCOM owing municipalities money, and I'm surprised you didn't talk about it. I should plead you to that, and I think if you don't mind, just share that with the Honourable Members. And I will ask the budget office to start, and then if the prof will come up, because he must be thinking the answer for my last question.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Okay, I thought you were following me. That's fine. But I think, Chair, you are proceeding to the first one, our work, just touch on our work. I think our work, the fact that we don't document doesn't mean our work is not credible. I think what we do, self our work is very empirically driven and very professional, and we evidence-based, yes, thank you, evidence-based, and yes, we can quote it, definitely, we quote it, and submit to make it available as we can use the report and presentation on our side, and it's very credible, and can use many times. Definitely, that's what we're here for, you know, for you to use our work, and it's on our web page there. And there's another point on, good point on, the issue of the director and the banking board. I think when you look at the presentation. I think it's slides, not the slides, it did indicate that you've got an advisory board, which the honorable chair is part of the board. So the question of the vacant director post, I will ask honorable members to direct your chair. you know, but of course, I mean, we it's beyond our control as the deputy director, but on a serious note, honorable chair is part of the advisory board, so maybe he can. Yes, that's also the parliament, that's beyond our office, it's the parliament matter, so it's something the chair can probably provide more direction. It's been vacant for since last year, September 2008. So, yes, so I'll use you to the chair to answer that one. The last one on the Act, on who we report to Honorable Joseph. The Act is quite clear, the budget office is accountable to parliament. So we annually, in terms of what we plan to do, we take the Act, what is required of us, these are the things we should do. We set them out in our annual improvements plan and say we're going to do this task and make provisions for research driven research requests in the committee. And at the end of the year, we pay annual report, this is what we said we've done. This is what we said we're going to do, we present it to the parliament. And it's part of the parliament's annual report. So we do report it and get tables as part of the executive authority's report there. In terms of the Act being an enabler and the money bills have recently, honorable session, the money bills have recently been amended. It was gutted in January and it was quite useful in a way because it provided the office, coverage on the office being a juristic person and having access to information. So we really look forward to using the amendment Act. It's very, very useful as far as we're concerned. I don't know if Sarah is going to add anything. Or the issue of the little work. What we can provide the little, what we're saying, the little work that we've done for the committee already is available. We can only put it, something back to show the committee. I think they would have the copies, but they can only share them with the committee. So it's available. Thank you. Check. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, this is terms of further identity. It's more political process because the director is appointed by the House. So the advisory board of the committee, the major can recommend that the mission is brought off by the National Assembly. So it's totally out of our hands. And I think everybody was just waiting for the new members, for the new chairs to be elected. So we will also have to be patient, or we had to be patient. So the office was run. We've got a very good process in place in terms of the Money Rules Act and the budget cycle, actually, of the tax work that we do. And the three of us just took the responsibility to make sure that we both produce our output and assist the committees or the members. And then there was something else in terms of who we report to, do we finally actually indicate it, but we don't report to the Secretary of Parliament because we're supposed to be independent. So we report directly to the Speaker. But in terms of we still receive our money from Parliament's budget, so we do submit all our quarterly performance reports in terms of expenditure and output, we report and submit to Parliament. So we adhere totally to the Public Finance Management Act, or the Effective Bill as the Act of Parliament.
Just on the work for ESCOM, both of those reports were actually the previous Appropriations Committee had asked PBO to produce those. The first one was linked to the Integrated Energy Plan and taking into account the finance and budget issues related to the choices of energy. And there was that was the debate at the time, whether we should go for nuclear arms. And so looking at the choices and the report is based on that. The second report was on ESCOM's finances. That was, I think, 2 years ago that we did that report. And that one, we tried to give a lot of background information to ESCOM and new generation goals, but also related to our ESCOM has been operating and the changes in ESOP's operation, so that we provided context for understanding its confinement. So that was another report we did for the probation committee as well on the request. So both of those were presented and tabled, and as the Masani said, all the previous work is available.
Maybe have access to
so it's available from the parliamentary website, but also from our we've also got a web page on Parliament site where we put those as well. So, and as soon as we report anything, it becomes publicly available. So it's not only available to the members, unless there's a requirement that it doesn't, but it's also immediately available to the public who can access it through our website as well. And also the Parliamentary Monitoring Group often puts up our reports as well. Thank you.
I don't know whether I understood
the
word response was in relation to the issue of the rate, the regional electricity distribution services, which in 2010-2011 there was a decision to probably end the process because of resistance from municipalities. And I just want to say that to our week, that the rationale was that municipalities realized that that process is actually taking away their ability as municipality to add the surcharge that I referred to earlier on, primarily because this is the easy cash cow that they have as municipalities, and they resisted consistently. So, I mean, this process was started long ago, but ultimately the red office, which was in Gauteng and in the Western Cape, had to close down. I was just saying, probably it has nothing to do with the energy. So, yeah.
Sorry, Chair, I think it was, wasn't that it was on speaking. I think it was on the first
speaking.
I think we're done with the question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to try to take it in the order the way it was raised. On more pieces, I think the through the chair, and I'm assuming that when I speak to the members, I'm speaking through you. You're not just speaking. Okay. The issue around the cost of electricity is quite an interesting story. I chair the Special Advisory Committee to the Cabinet's Interministerial Task Team on the ESCOM and municipal debt. And it was quite a long year investigation we did to advise Cabinet on it. The main point I can say to you is that the municipalities buy electricity from ESCOM and sell. There are municipalities, especially local municipalities, that buy electricity from ESCOM instead of 14 kilowatt. Just giving it. So I'm going to take numbers because sometimes numbers people run away with numbers and they will draw the number. The point I want to make: municipalities buy kilowatts per kilowatt electricity from ESCOM. And what if they do? In local municipalities, they sell it at a lower cost to the end user, to households and to businesses. And as a result, it's a little bit of a voodoo selling, voodoo budgeting and selling of things. Because you don't sell things at a lower cost than what you purchase it with. But there are reasons for it. In many of those municipalities, especially in the rural municipalities, the rural areas, the citizens can't afford to pay for electricity. And as a result, some of those electricity costs get offset against an industry, and the industry also has a problem with those rural areas. So we have, I've been consistently saying this the whole week now, that we have to struggle with deep pockets of poverty in the country.
We're also struggling with huge forms of inequality, and we sometimes overpower all these things. That in the metros, there's probably greater purchasing power of the level of income that people have, but also employment opportunities. You don't have the same in the rural municipality. So what then happens is that a municipality is only able to buy X amount of electricity, and then it's spread over the electricity to households and industries. Okay? Now here's the big issue when it comes to some of your, just in your area when you come from Northern Cape, Free State, one of the biggest problems, Northern Cape, the biggest problems in the town. Those are the most highly indebted municipalities comes from those, the ostensibly previously rural provinces, but with about this time used to be. Now, we were so, okay, that's it. I'm not getting into politics. Let me just say it. We were so in the highest establishing national government in 1994 to 1992. The best people got to speak up municipalities, to speak up provinces in a way that speaks up national government. And that's why every time I say economic intervention, still suffering from the old apartheid special development, but also many of those economic and social infrastructure matters which we had in the apartheid years. Notwithstanding the fact that we've done very, very, very well, exceedingly well as a country, given the apartheid state only delivered to a small amount of people, and we had to deliver for 44 million at the time, and now it's 45 million. But the thing is that municipalities cannot always afford the electricity that they need to get from this country. So what then happens in a municipality is that it's called a notified maximum demand. If you put this amount of electricity, that if you get closer to the amount of electricity you bought from this country, you need to flip the switch, meaning you need to switch off or push it a little bit down. So you'll see in some of the houses, where you live, hotel, the lights are going down, right? Or the geysers are lukewarm. That's what certain municipalities are treated on is doing brilliantly in Johannesburg. So they interfere. It's not interfere, but actually managing the electricity supplies of the citizens so they don't get into the space where they come from. Now, if you don't do that trip, your electricity cost will be higher at times for the year than what your monthly cost is because of the difference. Right? And many of the municipalities, because they don't have the qualified people in place, engineers and financial people, they agree on, they do agreements with ESCOM which they don't actually pay because the cost implications of that. And as a result, they got huge debt. But you also have to know municipalities that don't understand how, sometimes understand how to read the ESCOM invoicing that ESCOM sends to them. So if they dig a little bit deeper, then you will see sometimes municipalities don't actually owe ESCOM the amount of money that they pay. But they don't have the capabilities to do that. So what they then do, they sign debt repayment agreements. Let's say I put you up for example in this study. Get into a debt agreement, they're only collecting, they've got a deficit budget, they're only collecting 800 million rand a year. But their budget sits at 1.4 billion rand. So you see the gap there. But you also see the gap that they're actually signing a debt repayment agreement, ESCOM, knowing they can't actually afford to pay that agreement. So there's an issue of, we don't have the requisite capabilities in place in the municipality to negotiate on behalf of the citizens, some of the things. Now the metros are doing fine. Western Cape, sorry, Western Cape, Cape Town Metro, buy in energy from ESCOM, but they also generate their own energy. Mm-hmm. And they also sell the energy. So if you go up the mountain, if you go, you'll see the dams and stuff, that's where Western Cape is bringing their own energy. Same of Stirling and Gauteng, Johannesburg, they do the same. So they also petrol ops, so they buy from ESCOM, but they also sometimes sell to ESCOM. And as a result, it actually gets managed better. So,
So the issue about the electricity, we don't interfere that because that's why we have the National Energy, NASA, the National Energy Regulator, that deals with those type of practices. That's not our forte. What we look at is whether the revenue that the municipality is collecting is able to offset its constitutional and legal mandates. Okay. That's our business, to be able to look at that. And also,
so just on that point, so the Chairperson, is Prof saying that you are not able to now enter in the space, you are not able to enter in the space of the electricity, the billing? Yeah, that is the issue that I want to raise. But the word I wanted to use earlier on was that municipality is revenue from electricity as the only discretionary amount that they have. That's the word that I want to use.
Okay. But you see, but the electricity, correct? But
before you answer, I asked you something about electricity. I know it's one of your pet topics, so let's answer it today for the lot of questions to answer, and let's get it over.
Okay. Yeah, I'm still over. the tariffs for revenue collection on electricity is a leverage that municipalities use. It's the only one. So if you don't pay your electricity, if you don't pay your properties and your water and your refuge bills, then the municipality uses electricity to switch off. So they use it as a leverage. And that's the only leverage that they have. But there are interesting stories to be told about our perspective and what we see and what we can. On the conditional ground, phasing in, phasing out, the point that we're making and the consequential issues about the phase out is that it's not a problem of a conditional ground. It's the process towards introduction of a conditional ground. So that you can give an early warning to the systems become ready, the administration is ready for it, but if you're going to phase it out, you also inform the system so that people know exactly how to deal with the phasing out. Many a times, the conditional ground money that was given disappears in the overall system of the provincial fiscal. But national government departments like conditional grounds, because conditional grounds, give the minister and the chairperson those as a formal executive members, because it gives you a leverage over province, over province, over municipality. And the main argument around conditional grounds is its ability to deal with exogenous issues, but also its ability to deal with spillovers. Now, many times you're not able to assess whether there's a spillover effect on it. And where it is with conditional grounds are a very important instrument. But our point is about how do you phase it in, how do you phase it out, and whether there's enough time in the process. We can't do that. We can't determine whether which sphere of government is the appropriate sphere to deliver services. We respond to what the Constitution is saying on the decisions. Okay? You know there's been a debate about the negotiated conflict, the problems with the land policies, because of the outcome of it, we need to redo that. That's a political matter that is sort of to politicians. Because that's what there's under NZ4, the NAT and the PFP at the time, and the Alcata wanted 9. So our province is a bulwark of democracy, or the standing in the way of getting services quickly to our citizens and better services. That's a political question that only yourselves and your colleagues can resolve on a political basis. On the homeless question, the point that I was trying to make is that the homeless issue is a national question, and it's a national question when it comes to the issue of human settlements and housing. And there is a licensing question around that in terms of when and how and when the minister gives licensing for the delivery of houses and human settlements. That's the point we were making, and obviously that brings the whole question of how to deal with indigency relative to the need for other forms of social infrastructure. That was one of the more highly discussed questions. Then, when Dani, I hope I'm saying it correctly, if not my apologies.
That's it, more or less.
Yes, we've been taking into consideration the rural provinces, but here's the thing I want to remember, is that we have specifically in 2007-2018, we have made a submission of the government fiscal system and rural development in South Africa. And we've tabled with Parliament, but we also tabled with the provinces. Remember, when we finish with Parliament, we go to all 9 provinces, and we do the same there. So our statement that we're making about national parliament and interaction with our recommendations is the same statement that we make with the provinces. In the Limpopo, they asked me what the impact of the FFC's recommendations. And I said, honourable member, that's the wrong question. You should have to ask yourself that question. Because we make recommendations to you, and you will determine, you need to determine whether there's an impact of our recommendations. So so we do that when we also look at the equity question. It's uppermost in our minds. And then the question of Matapa, the issue is not about, I agree with these issues about policy, it's issues about implementation. But there's an old public finance fiscal policy theorem that says, if you cannot budget, you cannot govern. Now, many of these policies need to be costed at price. And many of the get implemented, we have the wrong set of people implementing it, this systems questions, etc. So we don't have a disagreement. We agree with you that the best constitution in the world, you have the best policies probably in the world, but the implementation is driving, and part of the implementation issues that have to be cut out everybody cost of our policy. So if we can't budget properly, we have a struggle to govern, and we see it exactly what's happening in other provinces. On the acceleration of accreditation, I think the point I've been making is a national point. It's not specific to the municipality of Tshwane. It's a national point of a need to look at accreditation. But this is a recommendation in terms of what I don't know. This is quickly shared because of the Tshwane municipality. On the special appropriations of loans, legislation, and how we interpret the meaning is. I think what is very clear for us is that the Constitution is the supreme law of South Africa. And what's captured in it is important. Notwithstanding other subsidiary legislation, such as the money bills and the PFMA, and any law that the Constitution that speaks to the Constitution or complies to the Constitution. The long and the short of it is that Parliament should ask, was FFC consulted? Either by a Parliament or directly. Where is the proof of the FFC's reply to that? It's almost like a certification process. I'm not suggesting, but it's like a certification process. So you can actually see also the parliamentarian because of the accountability of the overall system that is used. I think I've answered the question on the ESCOM question from Honourable Kumani. Honourable Joseph, would you be reported? We report to Parliament. Constitution is very specific to that. So we report to, if you like, we report to the Finance Committee. But we can also report to other committees depending as to whether those committees call on us. Who must consider the FFC's proposal? This committee, the finance committees, and the other two finance committees. But also when it's specific to sectors, then those committees that are specific to sectors need to respond to it. And that's critical. The time frames, I can't help you with the time frames. The law says the 30th of May or the 31st of May that we submit our recommendations to Parliament, and then it fits into the other cycle. So the recommendations that we're doing to Parliament, at the table of Parliament now, which we still are going to get the date and time of your committee, will be considered in the next budget. But in all the other things we do now, so it fits within that cycle. All our reports are available on the Google server. And I think what we could do, Chair, with your permission, we could pull out the recommendations, but also make sure that we get the full report. So if you can see that, the law doesn't hinder our performance. Nobody hinders our performance. We have our own structural and functional issues within the FSC. It's about how you are receptive to the recommendations, how you respond to the recommendations, and whether you tell us we are wrong. Because we need to know from Parliament if we are wrong, or whether we are looking at the wrong things. Not the day when we come there and we get told that we're looking at the wrong things. You need to say it beforehand. We would like you to explore this particular area. And then we will say, we can't do this on our own, maybe we should just ask the bus drivers to work with us on it, if they want to. You know? So there are lots of opportunities to deal with that. But the legislation doesn't hinder our performance. It's when we table with you your responses and conditions.
Thank you. I'm told that our next friends from the legal office would like to have a bite of the questions and the answers. Please do that.
Thank you, Chairperson. I mean, basically, we just want to make a point on one of the interpretation questions and what the members of the discussion are reading from the presentation. I think, Chairperson, on the issue between the interpretation of 214 and 220 of the Constitution in respect of the mandate on the functions of the FFC. I think, Chairperson, just a point of clarity that perhaps we just, on the basis of interpretation, as I indicated, we want to bring forth. I think the main concern and maybe the main confusion that arises is when one reads 214.2, which basically speaks to saying that there has to be consultation with the FFC, but it is in respect with the enactment of. There are two issues that we need to be clear on. Firstly, in terms of 214.1, there is an Act of Parliament which must provide for all those things that are listed from A to C. And then in terms of 2, sub 2 of 214, which is where the compulsory consultation as it reads that the Act referred to in subsection 1 may be enacted only after all these organizations that are listed there have been consulted and any recommendations of the Commission have been considered and taken into account. And if we look at Section 220, then Chapter 3, which establishes the FFC as well as broadly determines the functions of the Commission, it actually there says, as already pointed out in the presentation, the Commission which makes recommendations as emphasized in the capacity. But what is the problem then, Chairperson? I think it arises in the interpretation of the use of these three words. The first one being must consult or must be consulted, and the second one, the consideration of whatever it is that comes before whoever it comes to. So the distinction that needs to take place, perhaps for members long before the neighbor might need to come back in detail on this issue to just prepare the committee and provide information. In terms of what it is that when the Constitution is the supreme act in all above all the other legislation. In terms of 214, if we read it right now, it is speaking to the enactment of the legislation that will provide the direction as to how things are done. And that might still speak to the Mandating Procedures Act. It might also speak, because as you see, for instance, in A, it says that Act of Parliament must provide for the equitable provision of revenue. For an example, that one may understand to mean it speaks to the provision of revenue here. So there needs to be clear clarity, especially now, taking members forward,
when you speak to the question of must be or must have been consulted. And the members did raise this question as well to say, at what stage? Because I think the issue in terms of the consultation and who must be conducting the consultation, what are those stages? Because we need to understand the legislative process. In terms of, I think it's section 85, which sets the mandate of the executive. There is a stage for preparing and initiating legislation. So there might be places where this consultation is actually mandated and is compulsory, depending on the stage that it's at. And if furthermore, when we then define the term recommendation, we need to then look at its deeper interpretation against what the constitution says and against what other legislation is providing. So in terms of that understanding, I think we will have to come back and provide more clarity on the interpretation of this term as well as the mandate in respect of what Parliament must do and what it receives from the FFC chairperson. I think the other thing that I just wanted us to speak to was to indicate for purposes of our office and chairperson that the structures that have spoken and as the chairperson will be aware, this committee is doing a very much technical work which requires specific expertise in the field. So our office basically will come in relation to drafting processes as well as ensuring that the drafting conventions are complied with. But mostly, the Department of Finance and the structures that have already been spoken to, including the Parliamentary Budget Office and the support structure of the committee, they are best placed to provide the expertise and the direction technically on the terms and the mandates of the committee. I thank you.
Thank you so much, it's in game. Thanks. Prof, without creating a dialogue, do you want to say something? Please.
Excuse me, sir. Perhaps before.
Sorry. Let me tell you that there's a problem with Prof. I stopped him wanting to go out. He was going to come back. Do you want?
Yes.
Let's hear.
It's a right, actually, to what you're saying. The delivery question, Chair, that I asked from the digital, the preparative, what is now beginning to not the interest. The disconnect when Prof comes in, I've deliberately prepared myself a late session. But I have got a Linux brother who's assisting me and who instructed me. You have no authority up until you pass. If you are a student, you have no authority. Then don't say anything because you are a student. So now, I'm now being provoked by his semantics. Advice in terms of control, a recommendation in terms of. And to ask, if I take it from a layman's perspective, it's for FFC to say, if we don't take the accommodation and Parliament messes up, they will then say, there you are, we told you, and quote, as they have done in the last meeting. And I believe the same happened with the PDO. That we advised you, because they are not recommending, they are advising. And everybody asked, can we quote you? And it was exactly based on this, that if it's a valuable advice that you can take home, then it's equal to recommendation. But then I wanted the learned prof to at least clarify you when you respond. Let's go.
Prof, as I said, without provoking a dialogue, that's your part. I'll tell you how I want us to proceed on the subject.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I postponed money. I think that we there's some great confusion here. There's been a practice
I was in the National Treasury for 10 years and I was part of drafting the PFMA and a number of other financial laws. So the issue of precedence and the issue of practice. The point that we're making is not throw anything out. Everything is in place. You must consult before the introduction of financial laws, the FFC must be consulted. Before you shift the function, I'm talking about either from the province to the national, the FFC must be consulted. Because it has financial fiscal implications. Okay? So here's the point that my other two friends need to understand. What he's saying is that we are being consulted. But that consultation doesn't carry through in the working of the business of Parliament. So we are consulted on the probation, we are consulted on the Commission of Revenue, because we must be consulted before these things get legislated. The appropriation, adjusted appropriation, division of revenue, adjusted division of revenue, and any other particular financial law. So we are being consulted. Right? And in the consultation process, we inform you what our views are about. After we informed you what our views are about, it's your right to decide whether you want to agree with us or not agree with us or carry through, because the responsibility and the accountability sits with this committee and with other committees. The only difference here is what I'm saying to you, and I'm hoping that this committee will act quite differently from previous committees and other committees have a shift, that you will look at our recommendations and that you will consider and respond to our recommendations. Okay? So that we know that we don't give you a situation of garbage in and garbage out. So that it helps to strengthen the system, it helps you to understand a greater set of information for you to be able to engage each other on these things. That's what we said. So, we're not asking for changing of the law or interpretation or new interpretation of the law. We said we carry on in the same track. It's just the when and the how. And when we're doing it the way we're doing it. Our only problem has been we table our stuff because there are two systems here. There's the executive, because part of the executive is part of Parliament. And then there's this Parliament. I remember once Honorable Collins Giovanni once said to me, I'm also part of Parliament. And he's right. So that's all that he said. So the laws must carry on. We're doing it. It's just when you tell our recommendations, don't just ignore it. That's the only thing that you're making to us.
Okay. Thank you. I see it. My right corner. And I just want to let you conclude on this matter. Everyone who has been victorious knows that one thing they enjoy is not agreeing on anything. Okay, but on a more serious note, why in the same change the legal services and FFC and ourselves and the change of life? So can I request that Prof and legal services you revisit this matter and we are obligated to agree on something. And this is the first part. I don't know what you guys are doing, and you come back to us and say, no, we looked at this thing and we think this is the best one answer, right? I think that's what we do. Can I have the honorable members just to take a 10-minute comfort break and there's tea there, and you come back and then talk and continue with your national truth? I think you must go into the engage. Thank you.
That's why you're landing for high constitutional court.
Chairperson, that's how we, that's why Parliament has got the decisional force.